I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books in political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Colin Bird, Associate Professor of Politics and Director of the Program in Political Philosophy, Policy, and Law at the University of Virginia. We're discussing his 2021 book, Human Dignity and Political Criticism, from Cambridge University Press. Bird works on contemporary liberal political philosophy, particularly notions of individualism, identity, toleration, and respect, state neutrality, and democratic self-government. He has published two books and many articles on these topics. First of all, let me say, Colin Bird, welcome to the Political Theory Review.
I'm delighted to be here. Thank you so much for doing this. I'm greatly looking forward to the conversation. I think it's going to be a lot of fun.
Colin, yeah, it's great to see you. And I love reading this book, and I am looking forward to the conversation too. I found it's just such a great, fresh analysis of the concept of human dignity. I loved how you weaved together and appropriated both Marx and Hayek in one fell swoop. So that's impressive. So I'm looking forward to touching on that. So congratulations on the book. Let me ask you, first of all, you know, what motivated you to write this book in the first place?
Well, I think the main motive is actually, there's a main motive and a subsidiary motive. And the subsidiary motive, I think, emerged as the research was kind of going along. But the main motive, I think, is pretty straightforward. I mean, it seems to me that we're at an impasse with regard to the concept of dignity. On the one hand, it's a value, an idea that seems to undergird many of our most basic political attitudes and preferences. And since Rawls, in the Anglophone world, it's become more or less axiomatic for many that utilitarianism is inadequate because it fails to respect human dignity by instrumentalizing lives, treating people and their lives as just resources. And that argument has impressed a whole generation of figures, many of whom have gone in very un-Rawlsian directions. And as a result, appeals to human dignity now proliferate all across the political philosophy spectrum. It pops up in discussions of distributive justice, punishment, democratic theory, identity politics, recognition, and so forth. So it's everywhere. And I think it's not just an intellectual thing. I think, you know, in ordinary conversation, it tends to come up a fair bit. But at the same time, these ideas seem pretty elastic and vague. And there are a number of people who would define themselves as dignity skeptics, who think that this language is in the end merely rhetorical and ornamental, doesn't do any real theoretical work. So what I wanted to do in the book is, you know, it's a little bit like Kant in the end of the 18th century with regard to the rationalists and the empiricists, right? There are these two warring schools. We need to kind of step back and try to patiently see when this language of dignity is doing some work for us and when it's actually, as the dignity skeptics say, not so useful. And it is part of my, although I take the book to be defending a certain vision of human dignity, I am agreeing with the dignity skeptics about at least some common uses of the idiom. That's the main motive. I mean, the subsidiary motive that I think emerged along the way is that, you know, it seems to me that people are drawn to the category of dignity and the related concept of respect because they purport in this context to capture a really attractive idea. This is the idea that, sorry, we've got a dog here, that our lives ought to matter for their own sakes, right? I mean, I think this is what the wonderful Black Lives Matter slogan is tapping into. But I'm not really sure that we've thought hard enough yet about what it really means to value lives as mattering for their own sakes. And we've invested in a variety of theoretical frameworks that I think conspire to frustrate our comprehension of that commitment. I particularly mention here the tendency to invest in, you know, what I regard as scholastic paradigms, right? The Kantian tradition, the Christian theistic tradition, the Hegelian tradition of thinking in terms of recognition. Problem with that is I think it forgets something important, which is that these ideas, honor, respect, dignity, that they don't originate as technical terms in someone's philosophy. They originate in ordinary life. And I've tried in the book to get us back in touch with how we actually ordinarily use these concepts. The other thing I would say is that there's a tendency, which I strongly resist, as will emerge in this conversation, to think of dignity in possessive terms, right, as something that we have sort of in us as separate beings. This is connected to a certain kind of inside-out perspective on political theory, which I think has dominated for a long time. You know, Will Kimlicker famously says of liberal theory, but I think it goes for a broader swath, actually, that we live our lives from the inside. But I think in an important sense, that's not true. It seems to me that our lives are lived as much in others' responses to our lives and in their lives. And I think the idea of human dignity is important because it captures something crucial about our common responsibility to receive each other with respect rather than disrespect, and in that way to value one another for our own sakes. So those are the main motivations, I think.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, just to dig into a few of the things that you just said. I mean, the first thing is, I wonder if you could say a little bit more about the dignity skeptics that are out there. That because at one point early in the book, you say that we're all dignitarian humanists now, right? In some right. some sense, and so I trust the sort of Rawlsian critique of utilitarianism is fairly straightforward. So what's the kind of remaining resistance that you see out there that you're trying to address here?
Well, I think the important thing to say here is that I think there are virtually no dignity skeptics who have the temerity to actually say, pa, dignity, right? Who actually have the temerity to say, well, not only is dignity a kind of vague rhetorical concept, but actually it can be permissible and perhaps required to act against dignity. I mean, maybe there are some people out there who would be prepared to say something like that, but I suspect even if there were, they would be very quickly dismissed as not really being worthy of our attention. So I think, you know, what the dignity skeptics who are interesting and important say, they don't particularly want to say, look, the language of dignity is a language we should simply expunge. We have some rough and ready sense and of what dignity is, and it can have rhetorical mobilizing force in a variety of contexts, but it's just not precise enough to enable us to make progress in defending interesting, provocative, surprising, critical judgments. I think that's the form of dignity skepticism that is really pressing. I don't think there are any interesting dignity skeptics who say, you know, let's actually actively try to suppress human dignity. And if there are, I don't think they're interesting. In this respect, I think dignity skeptics take something like the same attitude towards dignitarian ideas that critics like Rawls take to utilitarianism, right? I mean, they acknowledge that, look, this idea that sparing people unnecessary suffering seems like a kind of self-evident practical axiom, right? They don't deny that has a certain kind of intuitive force. What they say, though, is that if you actually try to run a utilitarian calculus, right, the test is totally indeterminate. And in the end of the day, we'll wind up making our supposedly utilitarian judgments by smuggling in some other non-utilitarian content. And I think the dignity skeptics who are interesting say something very similar about the language of dignity. They say, well, it's a nice term. We're not actually against it. It's just that in order to get it to do any critical philosophical work, you've got to finesse it with some outside material or interpret it in the light of some more basic idea. And that's the form of dignity skepticism that I'm really attacking. But I'm also agreeing with them in part, because I think that's true. I think the dignity skeptics are right about the traditional conceptions of dignity. The possessive idea of dignity is an inherent, innate, immutable kind of occult quality that we all somehow have within us, deep within our souls.
Yeah. Do you think that, I mean, I'm curious about the sort of place of dignity in your view and in sort of political philosophy and the contemporary world broadly understood. I mean, do you take dignity, you know, to be the central or foundational principle for that sort of animates contemporary political philosophy and your political philosophy, or is it sort of one principle among many, I guess, as it were, that sort of can serve a role for political criticism. I ask this as a way to, you know, thinking about the motivation for the book. Is this, you know, this is absolutely pivotal because it sort of sits at the foundation of our political thinking, or is it maybe a more modest goal in the sense that it's, you know, one among many?
I think I want to opt for the slightly more modest option, but add to that that there is something in the language of human dignity that I'm not sure any of the other available kind of critical paradigms are in a position to deliver. And I think that's something that we sorely need these days. So let me explain what I mean. I mean, I don't think I want to deny that human dignity is the only thing, or that everything that has value in politics somehow reduces to this, right? Surely there are independent, pluralized sources of value. And sometimes we need to make arguments that don't particularly refer to dignity as the foundational value, but repose on some other independent principle or value. So that seems right. In that sense, I would go for the more modest option. But the thing about the language of human dignity is that it seems to me that it really is the only remaining idiom that we've got left that stands any chance of capturing a kind of universalist commitment to uphold a common humanity or something like that. I mean, all of the old, you know, religious categories, they all kind of claim to do this, but increasingly in a secularized world, those religious perspectives are bound to just seem optional for many and not things that have a kind of automatic mandatory pull. Utilitarianism and welfarism, of course, have their own problems. There's the problem of indeterminacy that I've mentioned, but also the problem of exploitativeness. I mean, this is Rawls's point, that we don't really, in the end, want to live in a technocratic world in which all there is to our lives is just to be a resource for some wider abstract machine that is somehow delivering aggregate welfare for some collective entity that doesn't seem to matter very much, right? So utilitarianism doesn't seem that great. No one any longer believes, as Marx in some moods did, that a universal class is going to initiate a revolution to decisively end our prehistory and usher in a rational and humane society. That seems completely fanciful. I'm not sure beyond the language of dignity and respect, we've got an awful lot else to work with. I mean, of course, you never know what's coming down the pike. Maybe there's a whole paradigm, you know, intellectual history is constantly surprising us. Human creativity is unpredictable. So maybe there's something else, right? But I think right now, that's the idiom that we've got that gives us any hope of being able to speak to each other as strangers, but nonetheless as sharing certain fundamental values as human beings, right? And if we get rid of that, this is the point about why I think it's important, then all you've got, since all these other things have failed, all you've got is a kind of endless contestatory agonism among different constituencies that are standing for different identities or different values, different religious proclivities or ethical standpoints. And there's way too much of that right now. And that's what, you know, I think people are really yearning, not just philosophers, but I think ordinary people. They're really yearning for some grammar for us to be able to talk meaningfully and intelligently to each other about what our common responsibilities just as human beings are. And human dignity holds out that promise. Now, whether it can redeem that promise is the question I try to answer in the book. I'm somewhat optimistic, but I'm under no illusions that even my revisionist version of the view has either solved all problems or will actually succeed in the long run in doing so. But that, I think that's why it seems important to me.
I completely, totally agree. Maybe this makes us both kindred Kantians at the end of the day, although you're more Hegelian than I think. But yeah, it strikes me that, you know, even you mentioned the agonist Democrats. I mean, it strikes me even with them, you know, there are some guardrails that they want to hold on to in terms of the agon in political society. And it seems to me that any kind of guide rails that you're going to put in place is going to have to appeal to some more fundamental principle. Probably something like human dignity when push comes to shove.
And
recognition, Rawlsian contractualism, a lot of the language, you know, that gets thrown around, it seems to me, has something like human dignity at its bottom, sort of animating it.
No, I completely agree. And in fact, you can find these dignitarian tropes in what some of these identity-based agonistic views are offering us. But I think often they're not really delivering a concept of human dignity that answers to this need for some kind of shared language that we can deploy across estranged constituencies to make meaningful critical progress, right? So, and for me, often what's wrong with the agonists is precisely that in their own way, although they often profess to be very kind of avant-garde and radical, oddly, they themselves cleave back to something like this more traditional possessive notion of dignity, because they associate dignity with whatever it is that's special about the particular identities that they're seeking to get recognized. And since dignity does, I think, carry a kind of contestatory impetus within it, right? I mean, you know, you stand up for dignity, you don't just meekly accept subordination, right? But that's a bad combination, right? And not, I think, a helpful one for a really compelling picture of dignitarian humanism, because it winds up producing a kind of militancy that divides estranged groups more strongly, rather than bringing them together and explaining why others have a reason to care about the oppression that people completely different from them are suffering, right?
Yeah, so is your answer to, I mean, you touch on this a little bit in the introductory chapter, but you know, the sort of tendency in political theory and political philosophy to sort of be skeptical of any sort of universalist claims, you know, mm-hmm. seeing them as sort of smuggling in liberal imperialism or whatever. Is your response to that something like, well, look, your principles automatically assume that? Or is your response to them something like, if you want to really hold on to anti-universalism, it's going to look like a bleak kind of world? Is it a sort of intrinsic view, or is it sort of an instrumental response in your mind?
I think it's a bit of both, probably. It's a good question. You've got me pondering there. I think in the end of the day, what I want to say is that the question about the sort of metaphysical standing of propositions or theories or concepts as universal is not, I think, a very interesting one. I take it that social criticism has always really been a matter of intellectuals, commentators, thinkers, journalists, sort of looting our vernacular categories to try to construct some somewhat more systematic conception that we can then bring to light to draw conclusions. I mean, I think this is the way that, for example, modern understanding of the state developed, right? I mean, Hobbes is basically taking a number of tropes from the feudal era, sovereignty, estates, this sort of thing, and he's reinterpreting them in a systematic way. I think, especially given Hobbes's own sort of metaphysical or non-metaphysical outlook, I think he'd be prepared to admit, look, these are coming in some level from a vernacular language that we've inherited sort of arbitrarily from history, right? So in that sense, they're not anchored in some kind of metaphysical skyhook, right? But he wants to say that they nonetheless have universal application in that we'll all be better off if we orient ourselves around these categories. And he has an argument that he thinks will convince us of that. And I think that's actually sort of the move I think dignitarians ought to make. I think they want to say, look, human dignity actually is a real thing. It's as real as the state is in something like Hobbesian theory. But it has the advantage over the state that it's not an institution. Right, it's a real thing. This is why I turn to Marx and this language of real abstraction, right? I mean, when he talks about abstract labor being sort of baked into the logic of commercial capitalism, one of the interesting things that he's saying there is that there's a kind of orderedness to capitalism, which we can decode and uncover theoretically, but that orderedness is not at all institutional. It's baked into other kinds of routines, even involving apparently completely independent action by agents interacting on the market, right? And I want to say something very similar about human dignity, that it's a real abstraction like that. We can conceptualize it as a real feature of human interaction and social routines. There's no reason to think that it can't then serve, if we do it well, as a kind of universal standard, even if we admit that its origins come out of a historically contingent set of traditions to do with honor and hierarchy and so forth. I mean, we're not bound to follow what it's been in the past. We can adapt it. That's how social criticism, I think, has always historically operated. And that's really what I'm trying to do here.
Yeah, that's great. So I'm gonna shift into the substance of your analysis and evaluation of the traditional notion of dignity, and then to turn to your, as you call it, revisionist approach. So maybe you could just sort of sketch for us you have a kind of typology of different types of dignity along two different dimensions. The first dimension of dignity is, whether dignity is something immutable or vulnerable to change and destruction. And the second dimension is whether dignity is inherent in the person, or I put it in terms of social construction. I don't know if that's a useful term. You sort of say it, and it's sort of interpersonal or socially ambient. I'm not sure exactly what the best language there is, but those two different dimensions yield a sort of 2x2 table with four different types of dignity. So maybe you could just talk about, sort of the traditional types and what you see to be the traditional types and their main features, and then the main features of your sort of revisionist approach. And then we'll kind of dig into the two different sides.
Yeah. So it may be a little bit difficult to capture the 4x4 in a recorded conversation, but let me at least try. So if you imagine your sort of four cells, right, you've got two rows and two columns, right? And the columns on the left refer to concepts of dignity that are alterable or changeable, right? They're not just immutable. They have a history. They change, right? The rows above and below refer to the extent to which dignity is somehow inherent in or possessed by separate individual persons, and the extent to which it's ambient in social relations. I don't particularly like the language of social construction here, but you're right that the language of ambience is a somewhat peculiar one, and I have some concerns about that. But the idea, at any rate, is to think that it's ambient in something, to use the earlier example, ambient in something like the way that statehood, right, the existence of states, is ambient. I mean, you can't locate the state in any local place, right? It doesn't have any empirical properties. It exists just to the extent that human agents interact, sharing certain understandings about their roles vis-a-vis each other. And if you can think of societies as more or less stateless, more or less anarchic, right, then we could say that statefulness, if you will, is a kind of ambient property that admits of degrees, right? That's the idea behind this notion of ambience, that we might think of human dignity as something that is in that way subject to alteration and change, diminishment, enhancement, that has a history and can in principle die, at least in certain sectors of human life. So the traditional conceptions of human dignity that I attack are basically the two on the column on the right. And what they both, the feature that they share is that human dignity is something that is unchanged despite whatever happens to people, right? And the top right box is the more traditional theistic and sometimes Kantian view that human beings kind of harbor a kind of image of God, or there's some special property or a capacity for autonomy, capacity for rationality, some feature in which this inherent property of dignity resides. And it doesn't matter how much you're abused, tortured, raped, and so forth, that inner thing will always remain untarnished and unchanged. The one at the bottom right is the same, except that it has a kind of ambient quality. It has this relational idea that ultimately dignity isn't so much an innate possession of the person considered separately. It's a kind of equal status that people have vis-a-vis each other. And here I have in mind people like Darwall, and I think probably also Rawls, those democratic theorists like Elizabeth Anderson, who invest very strongly in this idea that what it is to be a democratic, and Waldron too, what it is to be a democratic citizen is to share this basic status. That's obviously a social property. You can't specify it without relating one person who has a status to somebody else whose status is being compared with it, right? But they have this, they share the view that this status can't be changed, right? You know, you can be murdered and so forth, but your status of citizenship isn't itself, or dignity anyway, isn't itself damaged by that, right? So those are the two traditionalist views that I attack. And I go on to argue that actually there's room to argue, partly because it's been neglected, but also because I think it has independent philosophical purchase, that the two leftward categories, an idea of personal dignity at the top left. This is a kind of superficial dignity about how one presents oneself. It's the kind of dignity that you lose when you fly off the handle and get super angry. Or if this interview went super badly and you were starting to piss me off and I unplugged the computer and walked off in a huff, right? That would be a kind of to the detriment of my personal dignity.
Yeah, right? Look out, Colin. I'm going to needle you.
Yeah, and it could still happen. could still happen. I've certainly been there. and then human dignity, I say, is really the bottom left, right? And that's the thing that seems to me have been very under-theorized. And my effort in the second half of the book is a first crack at trying to theorize that. Sure, there are missteps, but hopefully the negative critical arguments about the traditional conceptions, maybe they might convince people to invest enough in correcting my missteps that this could become something of a conversation going forward. I certainly hope so. I'd like to think that that would be true.
Yeah, good. So let's start with a traditional view, the sort of Christian Kantian one. Dignity inheres in the person and it's invulnerable. I think kind of see the intuitive appeal to it, just in the sense that, you know, if you live in a society where you're, you know, regularly beaten up or humiliated or some sense, you can find some solace, right? In the idea that nevertheless, you possess something special inside of you, even if everybody around you tells you that you're not.
It might make it worse.
Okay, good.
I mean, it might make it worse in the sense that, you know, yeah. I have this special thing and because I have this special thing, I'm entitled to better treatment. And that's what makes all of this stuff so outrageous and harder to take, right? Might actually be easier to just think of yourself as a worm and then you don't have to resent it, right?
Right, but,
that's an aside.
Right. But at least in that case, I mean, that's helpful though, because at least in that case, you don't sort of internalize a false consciousness. You still have a remaining consciousness that would be outside that would serve as a critical purchase. So you can finally, when you're fed up with it, rally together your fellow minorities or whatever and say, we do have human dignity. So anyway, maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, that sort of traditional conception, where you, what you think it gets right, what more fundamentally you think it gets wrong.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the first thing to say here is that there's an important sense in which I would be prepared to grant the thought that there's something valuable in people that is not itself necessarily changed or altered by the degree to which they are abused, right? I think I'd be prepared to agree that there is lots of things about people that make them unworthy to be treated as slaves or exterminated and so forth. But I just don't think that we need the concept of dignity to explain or specify that. I mean, I think it's fairly obvious that human beings are capable of suffering. They have all kinds of things to offer. They have lives to lead. Truncating a life, constraining it, frustrating its efforts to live itself fully and vitally. Those are all horrible things that can happen to a person. And I don't see myself as denying that in that sense, people have a certain kind of inner value, if you want to put it that way. I just want to say, I don't think it's helpful to baptize that inner value as a kind of inherent property of dignity, right? And part of the reason for this is that I think there's something disabling about that idea, at least with regard to the critical value of human dignity. I mean, if human dignity emerges unscathed, regardless of how you're treated or abused, right, how is it in any meaningful sense at stake in what happens? What reason do we really have to care about it, to come to its defense, to mobilize common resources in defending it, right? I mean, if we know that it's guaranteed, you might think, well, we don't need to bother. And I mean, I think there's a number of cheap shots in the early part of the book, and I accept that they are sort of cheap shots, but they're also, there's a tradition of thinking this way, so I can count people like Rousseau as being kind of on my side here, right? But the cheap point is that, you know, maybe it's not an accident that during the period that theism was in charge and people were bleating on about an unchangeable dignity that inheres in people's soul, maybe that's a reason for that can help explain why these institutions were so indifferent to the abuse that was going on around them. Because after all, why does it matter? If this is a tiny, finite speck in an infinite ocean of bliss in the hereafter, you might not think that this stuff really matters. And, you know, Rousseau in the chapter on civil religion, as you know, I think is very good on this. He says, you know, the problem with Christianity, at least, or some branches of it, is it has this otherworldly quality. It invests in a kind of compensatory fantasy about another world. And that's a way of turning one's back on what really matters here, right? And my worry about these innate inherentist conceptions of human dignity is that they encourage a certain kind of complacency about that. You know, Clarence Thomas, when he says, well, the slave's dignity was untarnished. But I think we want to say something stronger. I want to say that the reason why slavery was such an abomination was that, at least with respect to their relationship with their wider society and the powers that be, human dignity was essentially dormant, non-existent. That they were, you know, human dignity was denuded. The opportunity for human dignity to live in the lives of those people and their relations to others, that opportunity was completely missed, and to the detriment of social relations. And that's what's at stake, right? So I'd like to think of this as orienting us back towards how dignity can have a life in the world, as opposed to being a kind of lifeless abstraction, which I think it often becomes in these traditionalist versions.
Yeah, that's good. I totally agree on that. I mean, it seems to me though that say on a Kantian view, and you talk about how Kant is different from these folks that you were just criticizing, but it strikes me, you know, part of what's going on there is not to think, you know, that there's this, you know, glowing orb within you that's never going to change no matter what, but that you have some kind of special status that demands that you do something about it, right? That you realize it in the world. And it demands that you not turn yourself into a worm, for example. I mean, yes. Kant admits that, you know, you can turn yourself into a worm and don't complain if you get stepped on then, right? So that it brings with it that inner sort of status or value, brings with it a certain kind of injunction to realize something in the world. I mean, in that way, it makes it possessive, which I think is, you know, maybe at the heart of that you mentioned earlier, that what's really the problem with this kind of traditionalist view is it's possessed by particular individuals. But anyway, in any case, maybe you say something about that sort of maybe revised traditionalist view and.
Well, first of all, I mean, I'm really glad that you picked up on the fact that I regard Kant as having an interesting hybrid view, right? I mean, he's a sophisticated thinker and he doesn't have this really naive view that there's just this sort of inner thing, right? But what he basically does, at least as I read him, is to take the kind of alterability of human dignity, such as it is, and locate responsibility for managing and protecting one's own dignity, locate that to the inner deliberative forum. And, you know, politics is relevant to that because he has in his political theory a view in which it's important to maintain certain kinds of constraints to give separate individual autonomous agents the space to conduct this inner warfare on behalf of their own dignity for themselves. And paternalism and things like that are really bad from a Kantian point of view because they infantilize people and deprive them of the power of maintaining their own self-respect, right? So I get that about the Kantian view, and I think it does have some attractions. I mean, I it's not an accident that people like Rawls are then led, I think, to think of human dignity often in terms of these reflexive attitudes, attitudes of self-respect and so forth. But I guess what I want to say to that is that this isn't getting what I think we want out of a out of the concept of human dignity, which is the sense of common responsibility, right? And recognizing when other people are humiliated and what can we do to vindicate their lives for the sake of maintaining something like a dignified human existence, right? And, you know, there's this strong impetus in Kant to resist that sort of thing, which is why so many libertarians who just want to say, just let let the free market do its thing. We, you know, that's really in the end the only thing we can do for the sake of human dignity. Because what we're really trying to do is to protect this inner forum. And I don't think that's what we really want. And furthermore, I think there's something deeply odd about thinking that reflexive attitudes like self-respect and self-esteem and so forth are ultimately political. I mean, why should political theory be concerned with our relations to ourselves? I mean, it strikes me that that's the sort of thing that is more at home on the therapist's couch or in the confessional box or something like that. It's not really obviously a public concern. So a lot of this post-Rawlsian stuff has this peculiar feature that it theorizes human dignity as an important, indeed adamant, vital, overriding, unconditional common responsibility. And then it leapfrogs over all of the things in civil society that you might worry are actually undermining human dignity and goes directly to this inner sanctum of personal deliberation and seems concerned about it only to the extent that we preserve it intact for individuals to separately discharge their responsibility to themselves. And that's the sense in which it preserves this possessive quality. And I think the reason why it unwittingly perhaps promotes this agonistic view in which in the end, we're all looking at politics from the inside out. And what we're really concerned with is protecting our own little patch and making it psychologically livable, right? But if we're already pushed back that far into sort of stoic techniques of the self, you know, how to cope with an absolutely alienated existence, right? It seems to me that we've leapfrogged over all of the stuff that ought to matter if we're concerned, as dignitarians claim to be concerned, about ensuring that human lives matter for their own sake. And they matter for their own sake, I think, externally, in how they're valorized, received, and respected or disrespected in day-to-day institutional and other interaction.
Yeah, that's good. I suppose it depends on, in this conversation, sort of what you take to be the main worry in social criticism. I think it seems to me this raises a big question here because, I mean, you know, try this on for size, because it seems to me that, you know, concerns about paternalism are, seems to me to be real concerns. Like, for example, you start the book with B.F. Skinner and sort of the behaviorist revolution in social sciences. And, you know, there, I take it there's some worry, not just among libertarians, but among others, that, you know, the kind of mathematicization of human life and the transformation of us such that we can be sort of manipulable features of a social system by a government or by, you know, capitalism or whatever, that maybe most famously in the form of Nudge, you know, the Cass Sunstein, Richard Thaler book, is to sort of just sort of nudge people around, I think is, you know, one could, I think, you know, multiply the examples of this kind of, you know, paternalism, but I take it that that's, you know, that that's a real worry on the part of some, and some want to say that is an infringement on our dignity. I'd be interested in that. And it, you know, I mean, one doesn't have to go full libertarian on this, because I think, for example, Kant also thinks that there's, you know, justifies principles of welfare and redistribution such that we need to support the poor and we can't just leave them to their own devices and whatnot. So you know, you want to build in sort of material protection, but also sort of give support for self-development and achievement of self-respect. So what do you think about that?
Well, I guess with regard to Skinner, I mean, my main point there is to say, you know, Skinner sets up this ultimatum, right? I mean, either you side with tradition and, in his view, superstition, and you buy into this inner homunculus, this inner self that is in some, has some kind of religious or sacred significance, right? The kinds of traditional conception of dignity that I want to criticize. You either go that way and, you know, stick your heads in the sand and turn your back on progress, or you just go full bore technocracy, behavioral conditioning, positive, negative reinforcement, Walden 2, all of that. And my basic line on this is that this is a completely false alternative, and that what is potentially valuable in my reconceptualization of human dignity is that it shows there's ample room for a sensible alternative to both of those, right? And I don't see really why my account would be any more sympathetic to manipulative efforts to nudge people this way and that. You know, you want people to attend to each other in a way that respects them as independent agents with the capacity for choice and all the rest of it. That's all perfectly compatible with my view, as long as you don't identify the capacity for choice with human dignity in the traditional way. Perfectly happy to go with that. And in fact, you might even think that, you know, this could give a better account of what's infantilizing about certain kinds. You know, if we socialize people from a very early age to become super, super dependent, super, super, you know, vulnerable and so forth, you know, we are attending to them in a rather infantilizing way. And that will be a fact about their life narrative. It's a fact about how they are handled. It's not just that they're treated as children, it's that actually they, in a way, their lives become childish as a result of the fact that they're not being attended to in a genuinely respectful way. I mean, this is a thing that I think we'll agree about this, that it's something that we as university educators confront all the time, right? I mean, we want to cultivate in our students a certain independence of mind. And it's a complicated dance, right? You don't want to manipulate them into believing certain things that you want them to believe. But equally, I don't think either you want to go to the other extreme and just present historical views, philosophical positions, theories as just so many cereal varieties on the supermarket shelf, and say they're all basically equally as good as the next, you pick, right? It's got to be somewhere in between those two things. I mean, I'm not in the end finally sure what my view would imply about nudge policies of one sort or another. But certainly strong forms of paternalism would, I think, be ruled out, because the paternalist is not attending respectfully to the agent with which they're concerned, and is therefore not imbuing their relationship with the kind of dignity that I claim is the result of appropriately respectful attention to them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, humiliation is a difficult concept, because it can mean a couple different things, but, you know, because humiliation and grinding forms of poverty right? The Kantian view and your view would agree that that's not acceptable. But, you know, something like hate speech, Jeremy Waldron takes this up, right? As a, you know, and so would a human dignity position sort of, you know, one way to take a human dignity position, maybe the Kantian view, although I'm not sure, is to say hate speech should be protected because we should, you know, not be paternalistically telling people what they should and shouldn't be saying, right? And that, you know, we should be according people their dignity to be able to decide what's good and bad, so forth kinds of speech. Another view of human dignity would be to say that, well, hate speech is a form of humiliation and should be restricted in certain ways. It causes harm and it causes psychological aversive thinking and so forth. I'm just thinking of the top of my head, but it seems to me that maybe some of the action here in terms of, you know, if I'm trying to locate, it seems to me what I'm hearing is, you know, like that your view can incorporate some of the worries about paternalism with some of the more worries about social justice and so forth. I'm wondering if, you know, where the pressure points are and if you think that there would be any pressure points here.
No, I think there definitely are. And I don't think, you know, on something as complicated as hate speech, one would even expect a kind of theory that's going to give you a completely unequivocal, you know, magic bullet, clear, sharp, bright lines account of this. You know, I touch on Waldron at one point in the book, but I deliberately avoid being drawn on the question of whether hate speech restrictions would be compatible or incompatible with an improved, revised conception of human dignity along the lines that I propose. I mean, thinking, you know, off the top of my head about this, I guess what I would say is that in a society in which something like a tradition of vigorous and constructive and attentive mutual discussion, the kind of thing that Mill clearly has in mind as an ideal. If we could count on that sort of background, then I think individual sporadic incidents of hate speech here and there are probably not going to be enough to damage the target's life in the way that a dignitarian would be concerned about. Because after all, in such a culture, there would always be, we hope, more speech that is vindicating the victim by pointing out the absolute rubbish that is being spouted by these white supremacists or whoever it is. Now, today, I would say it's not so obvious that we're anywhere close to being able to count on that sort of tradition. But the reason for that is, I think, interesting, or at least one of the possible reasons for it is interesting and related to my story, right? You know, one of the things that Mill says in On Liberty, which is often overlooked, is that he refuses to associate our relationship to our beliefs as a purely proprietary one, such that if somebody criticizes me, they're doing something akin to theft, right? They're taking my truth away from me, right? Rather, what he says is that, you know, people who want to restrict speech under ideal conditions are stealing from the commons, right? They're depriving us of a common resource we all need in order to be able to reason intelligently together and disagree productively and try as best we can to sift out the bullshit from the stuff that has some kind of reasonable claim on our attention. But I think what's developed, for complicated reasons that take us far away from my book, what's developed lately, and it may have something to do with online media, is a world in which people now do think about their beliefs as their own private domain, and criticism is regarded as a kind of personal attack. And I think that's actually the fruit of a certain kind of separatist identity politics about belief that is precisely what I think we need to be getting away from. We need to somehow restore the sense that our beliefs are our common responsibility. We share a common responsibility not to disrespect people by exposing them to stuff we know, or at least have every reason to believe, is total bullshit. The question is, how do you restore that? I don't have a good answer to that. But I'd like to think that my revisionist conception would help us to theorize how we could think about that intelligently. And I'd also maybe not like to think, but I suspect that the more possessive conceptions of dignity, which maybe encourage people to stand on their dignity and say, look, I don't care what your arguments are. This is who I am. And the election was stolen, and I don't care how much evidence you put before me. And what it is to be, to stand up for your dignity is just to refuse to compromise in the face of manifestly powerful evidence to the contrary. And that's stupid. And that can't possibly be any sort of dignity that we care about. But I do worry that traditional conceptions may encourage that sort of highly individualized relativistic conception of our relations to our beliefs and commitments and religious attitudes and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's good. And I maybe put it in a slightly different way, which is, you know, that one of the things that I like about your view a lot is it's very attentive in the way that you just illustrated to the empirical conditions under which, you know, dignity is either manifested or threatened, right? Where, you know, the threat, I take it, of the possessive view is I possess this thing as an individual. And it doesn't matter what the empirical conditions are outside of me. I'm a free, sovereign individual, and to hell with the rest of you, right? Whereas, you know, a sort of relational conception of dignity has to be aware of exactly what those relations are in order to characterize. So I think that's great. And so maybe the possessive view would have the implications that you suggest. I'm not sure, but it certainly tends to stray more away from actual clear empirical analysis. I don't know if you have
any thoughts about that. Yeah, well, that's definitely, you know, what I would hope to be a selling point of my view, that at least it gives us something to analyze in at least a quasi-empirical way. You know, I mean, I haven't written this up at all, so I'm now going out a bit on a limb, but I am interested in this phenomenon of sort of deliberately winding people up, you know, triggering the libs. I mean, I think there's an awful lot of that going on. It's not that people really sincerely believe that what they're saying is the truth. They know full well that it's BS, but they spout it and express it in a way that is precisely designed to irritate and provoke an angry reaction in their interlocutor, right? And there's a manipulativeness in that. And what I want to say is that a conversation, or what I would like to be able to say perhaps, is that a conversation that is marked by that sort of initial motive and the likely effect on the interlocutor, who might then, you know, lose their cool and lose their deliberative consideration in the heat of the moment, and perhaps storm off or maybe even come to blows, right? There's a kind of manipulativeness about this that would precisely be to the detriment of human dignity, in the sense that, you know, if you think about a brawl or a riot, right, this is something in which large numbers of people are engaged in, or a shouting match, right? There's not much human dignity in those transactions. It's not a question of whether something inside one is being protected or not, nor is it a matter, I think, of abstract relations of civic status. It's just much more superficial. It's that, you know, people who are resorting to arms in this situation it's a shame for rational beings to stoop into that sort of way of interacting, right? And there would be room then to argue that, look, a kind of account of what it is to disagree and argue intelligently would be one that would maybe not require, because I wouldn't regard this as a sort of legally enforceable thing, but in terms of, you know, ideals of free discussion, you'd want speakers to attend to each other such that they don't just regard them as people to be wound up or manipulated or provoked into a stupid reaction, but you're taking their thoughts seriously and reflecting on them. Yes, maybe being abrasive sometimes and so forth, but at least in some sense, sharing common responsibility for the dialogue itself, and that it occur in a respectful way as opposed to a violent or manipulative way. So One of these days I'll get around to writing something along
that. That's good. And I promise we're going to get back to your book, but I just wanted to ask one last question before we get to your developing your revisionist view with, and this will serve as a transition, but it strikes me based on what you were just saying that you might think that there could be a kind of teleological side to your view, which is something like, look, I mean, one way to and it could be an Aristotelian teleological view, right? Like sort of a naturalist view, but a human dignity involves a certain kind of comportment, a development of a certain character, an achievement of a certain ethos and disposition towards other people. And one can live up to that telos as a human being, or one can fail to live up and sort of humiliate oneself. I associate this with maybe, you know, my work on Kant. So I associate this with sort of develop, you know, Kant's own work. But I don't know if, you know, have you thought about conceiving it in teleological terms, your whole project, your whole revisionist approach, or do you kind of resist that way of thinking?
I think I want to resist it.
Okay, tell me why, because I am not, interested not, in this. Yeah.
Not because I think it's a bad view, right? But just because I'm not sure that it comports with, you know, our kind of inherited understandings and intuitions about what dignity is like, right? I mean, here's my thought. The teleological view, one way to maybe capture my resistance to it is to see it as, in a different way, falling back on this reflexive inward relation to self kind of view, right? That, you know, ultimately we're responsible for realizing our telos and doing appropriate Aristotelian character building and all the rest of it. And I guess I want to say that is really individuals' private responsibility. And it probably isn't something that is a public thing in the way that triggers a concern, an adamant, unconditional concern for whatever protections we associate with human dignity, right? And this is, I think, for me, connected with this, I think, attractive feature of human dignity that Pico, you know, drew attention to early on in all of this, right? That human dignity protects a human chameleon, right? And people are just different. And they're not only different from each other, there's no particular reason to suppose that an individual life will necessarily display a high degree of kind of teleological coherence, right? I mean, people may flit from one profession or career or form of life to another, and there may not actually be any great teleological coherence to any of this. But I don't want to say that that means we should suggest that there's something that makes it harder for that person to share in human dignity just because their lives are relatively incoherent. You know, I can be this person at one stage in my life and a different kind of person, a different stage in my life, but I'm still entitled at both phases to be treated with respectful attention. And that's the public part of this that's important. The aspect of character development, while that's very important from an ethical point of view and a personal psychological point of view, and I have no beef against Aristotelian ethical analyses, that's fine. I think that a commitment to human dignity as we've inherited it is going to bring with it this modernist split between public and private, and is going to say, well, in the end of the day, responsibility for our self-respect, our self-esteem, our character, that's something that's better left to individuals to work out and negotiate for themselves, perhaps precisely for the reason that trying to kind of interfere too much would be paternalist in the nudging way that you were objecting to earlier. It would actually be a sort of infringement on human dignity by you know, attending to others in an infantilizing, manipulative fashion.
Yeah, great. So let's talk about your revisionist view. The way I characterize it in my head after reading the book, and tell me if this is right. It seems to me that, you know, you're making a move much like Hegel made against Kant, which is, you know, that dignity for Kant is inside the person, whereas for Hegel, dignity is out there in the ethical mm-hmm. life of the people, right? So it's, you know, that I think is in a nutshell how I think of your view. You don't draw on Hegel, but you draw on Marx. It'd be interesting. I'd love to hear your view on it, Hegel, Marx, but maybe that's a conversation for another time. But maybe what I thought we could do is sort of walk us through what I took to be, you know, sort of the main parts of your theory. Number one, you think of dignity in performative terms rather mm-hmm. than reactive terms. Number two, dignity is connected to respect most fundamentally. And number three, dignity is constituted by an economy of respect. There's this sort of use this economic mm-hmm. Metaphor. I'm not sure if those three sort of main topics exhaustively, you know, capture what's a complicated view, but maybe this, you know, can serve as a kind of roadmap for thinking about it. So maybe you could just, you know, sort of start talking about the kind of performative character of dignity in contrast to the what you characterize as the reactive type of dignity to kind of get us started in thinking about your view.
Yeah, I mean, let me introduce that by just reacting to what you said about Hegel. I mean, it was interesting that you brought Hegel in, and it's made me think about whether I should have discussed him more. I agree there are definitely affinities, certainly the stuff about narrative, the stuff about not sort of, you know, separating things, but seeing them in a kind of narrative relation to each other. That's all deeply Hegelian. Where I think my view is going to differ from an authentically Hegelian view is that in a way it does preserve an element of the inwardness of the traditional view. It's just that it displaces it from the target of respect to the respecter, right? So when I talk about, I don't actually talk about dignity as being performative, I talk about respect as being performative. And the contrast here is, on a traditional view, there you are, you're on the screen, somehow I'm supposed to detect an inner property or some kind of status of dignity in you, and respect is the appropriate response to that. That's a reactive notion of respect. What I want to do is replace that with an inversion and say the relationship is the opposite, right? I react to you as you are, and if I react to you respectfully, if I tend to you in a respectful way, the effect of that will be that our relationship will count more for human dignity, if you want to put it that way. It'll imbue our relationship and perhaps what our conversation represents in relation to a larger intellectual project. It will imbue that with a property of human dignity. So it's I have this little tag that comes up at various points throughout the book, and maybe it's a little trite, but I like to say that on my view, dignity is to respect as dearness is to love, right? So, you know, I don't love someone because they're already dear, right? There's not some inherent property of dearness that attracts my love. There's certainly some people who've sort of defended that view, but I think it's an idiotic view, right? If I fall in love with a person, I fall in love with them, right? And the performative element is then that if we follow through the scripts of loving relationships, if we do it in a reasonably good way, the effect will make us dear to each other. And that will be a fact about a social fact about our interaction. And I want to make exactly that move with regard to respect and dignity, right? If we treat each other with respect, according to various recognizable scripts, that will imbue the relationship with the kind of human dignity that I think matters, right? That's the thought.
Yeah, good. You know, I want to talk about this notion of respect because it's, you know, pivotal to your view. You know, you contrast it with love, which is, you know, that seems like the right move. Maybe you could say a little bit about what respect means. I mean, as a, you know, devotee of Kant, it gets me thinking, you know, what actually is the content of the concept of respect? You know, Kant himself sort of traces respect versus love back to a kind of a basic affect of human beings of repulsion and attraction, and like his, mm-hmm. you know, his early work is a kind of Newtonian analysis of these of these sorts of things. What is it that respect as opposed to love is, you know, is it attract, it binds human beings together, respect, repels us apart. But why does it repel us apart? Is it a recognition of our independence towards one another? I mean, that seems to be you know, a Kantian approach to this. What do you think of it? And when you're conceptualizing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, let me first of all say, I mean, it's striking that you raise this jump. Well, what the hell does respect mean, right? That's actually where this project began, right? It didn't start out as a project about dignity particularly. It started out as a project we use this language all the time, but what does it really mean, right? And that then led into this larger project about dignity. But I mean, with regard to respect, I mean, I basically, and here I give full credit, I just lean on the analysis of respect. I disagree in some ways, but to a large extent, I'm just taking over the analysis of respect that David Velleman offered in a famous paper from about probably 15, 20 years ago now, called Love as a Moral Emotion. And, you know, there are some aspects of that article that I profoundly disagree with, like most of the critics, right? So Velleman winds up with the, I think, very odd view, because he's a sort of traditionalist about dignity, that since respect and love both involve dignity, when I fall in love with a person, my love for them must in some way be a reaction to detecting their dignity. And I find that a deeply implausible account of what it is to love a person, or how love evolves and comes about. And most of Velleman's critics have pressed that point against him. But the basic phenomenology that he gives about respect and love, I think, is entirely correct. And I give full credit to him for this, because I'm just basically leaning on it. He says both love and respect are second order affects. They're second order affects, or motives in his language, in the sense that they are emotions or affects that arise in response to an already existing affect, right? That's why they're second order, right? I have an affect, and I now have an affective reaction to that affect, right? That's why. And what he says about love and respect is that both of them have this property of arrest. They're an emotional attitude such that one arrests or impedes a pre-existing, and wants emotionally to impede or resist an existing emotional impulse. In the case of respect, the emotion that is, and this is, I think, perfectly compatible with the Kantian view, the emotion that is arrested or resisted is the emotion of self-love, right? The desire to secure your own good, right? And the presence of another person triggers an emotion such that you realize you must arrest that self-love for the sake of this other person who's now in your presence and who stands to be affected in some way by what you might or might not do. And so respect comes about by attending to whatever it is about another person that might legitimately cause you to revise your own plans in your own name. In the case of love, the emotion that is arrested is this emotion of being emotionally invulnerable to other people, right? That fortunately we are able to proceed in life because it's a fact about us. I don't know if this is a Darwinian fact, but it seems to be true that for the most part, we do not feel directly other people's pain and pleasure and suffering and enjoyment, right? We're insulated from it, right? And in fact, it'd be intolerable if we were constantly feeling everybody else's pain and pleasure, right? What love does is to disable that, right? It's an affect such that my emotional invulnerability to the beloved is arrested and I become emotionally vulnerable to them, right? And that would be compatible with the sense of, you know, attraction as opposed to repulsion. It certainly fits reasonably well with that. And that's the basic analysis I have. It's in many ways a fairly traditional one. I think the only respect in which my view may be a little bit controversial is that I think that once you see it that way, this kind of standard distinction between appraisal respect and recognition respect that was drawn famously by Stephen Darwall, that distinction erodes a little bit. Because I think simply appraising a person, you know, giving somebody an A as opposed to a B, right? I don't think that's respecting them. I think that's just appraising them, right? The respect part comes in when you are disposed to attend to that person in a way that arrests your own self-interest and self-concern because of your appraisal. So if I have higher appraisal respect for this expert as opposed to that one, right? What I'm saying is that I'm more disposed to arrest my self-concern by listening to that expert rather than this one. And that, I think, is not really that different from what Darwell calls recognition respect. But I don't think that point is doing a whole lot of work in my argument, because I think for the most part, what I'm talking about is some version of what Darwell calls recognition respect. The only difference is that I want to have a narrative account of it as something that occurs over time rather than a kind of atomic story about how on an individual occasion I do or don't show respect in some particular act that we might be evaluating, morally speaking.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point, the sort of narrativity that connects with the performativity on your view and the relational character of it. So you really get that flavor. I wanted to ask, you know, on this point, in part I bring it up because it seems to me there's some, I guess, tension between this understanding of respect and dignity with, maybe you could call it, maybe this is a heritage from the more traditionalist conception, but the sort of hierarchical and status-based approach that are traditionally characterized with these terms, right? I mean, this is something that I guess Waldron, you know, in his work on dignity draws attention to, the way in which dignity is connected with status, and the status, dignitas in the Roman world. It becomes, you know, in a sort of egalitarian understanding in his view. So how do you think about the sort of hierarchical, heritage of this concept? Is this something that you think can and should be disposed of, or do you sort of incorporate it in some way?
I think I incorporate it. In fact, I think I hold a stronger view. I think I regard some element of this hierarchical kind of precedent relationship as being ineradicable. I think the attempt to argue that any sort of respect has no kind of hierarchical comparison in it whatsoever, I think that's doomed to fail. I think that's absolutely baked into the concept. Now, that doesn't mean that I think that people who recruit the category of respect to something like an egalitarian agenda are completely confused. It's just that I think we have to face up to the fact that the kinds of egalitarian relationships that the right sort of respect brings about require some people to defer to others and to give them a certain kind of precedence. That's why it involves a certain kind of humility. I mean, to use Kantian language, it involves bending the knee before another. And that's the point about this arresting self-concern, right? I mean, if I'm a sort of psychopath, self-interested, Skinnerite utilitarian, right? You're constantly gonna be asking this question, well, what reason do I have to care about another person, right? And that's not really hierarchical. It's just not caring. It's not making any comparison at all, right? Whereas I think that it's just baked into the idea of respect that I'm willing, under some conditions, I should forfeit something of value to me for the sake of the other person. And I think we just have to acknowledge that I'm, in that sense, in that transaction, I'm putting the other person above me. That I don't see how you can get away from that. You are putting another person's interest in a certain limited context ahead, or you're according it precedence over your own self-concern. So I think you're always going to have that. I think that's part of the concept. And as you know, you've alluded to this already. I mean, this is perhaps the most recherché part of the book. I mean, I use that idea to then construct the thought that, well, actually maybe human dignity is constituted by a certain kind of effective economy, right? In which these payments of attention and their outward manifestations and treatment and maybe some symbolic behavior, they're effectively tokens in which respect is paid. And they're tokens in which the value of lives is expressed. Now, I don't think of this as in any sense like a market for commodities, right? But it is a certain kind of economy because it involves the circulation of putatively valuable things that are seeking to valorize themselves according to some common understanding of what has value and what doesn't, right? And this is where the Hayek stuff comes in, right? Because I, you know, I'm being really subversive here because I'm trying to kind of, as far as possible, give Hayek as much as possible and then turn the tables on him and say, well, that's why this libertarian stuff in the end doesn't make sense and can be exposed as a kind of weird collectivism, right? Where you're really doing exactly what Marx says political economists always do, which is saying that what really matters is the system of market exchange. That impersonal idol then becomes the thing for the sake of which everything else matters, right? And I think the dignitarian response to that is to say, no, people matter. And that means we need an account of the informational economy by which agents can acquire knowledge that their lives are being valued for their own sake. And I think emotions like love and respect are a crucial part of that. And it's why we care about them. It's why we get upset when somebody breaks up with us. I think most people, if they're really being honest with themselves, would say there's a sense in which their lives have lost value because they're no longer dear. Someone's told you to sod off. They don't want to associate with you. And especially if they do it without any explanation whatsoever or any excuse, right? There is a real sense in which the value of your life, your life matters less for its own sake as a result of that. If you can't command any love at all, right? I mean, I don't think this is connected to dignity because I don't think dignity is really a matter of love. But it's that sense of an economy where we're all sort of floating in an implicit economy in which we exchange with each other. We mediate each other's value through our willingness and our disposition to respect or love one another, right? That's how I get into all of the stuff about Hayek and how we depend on these emotions and their expression for information about how we matter. And so to go take it back to, say, the Black Lives Matter movement, I mean, if you were running the Black Lives Matter story through my account, right, what you'd be saying is that Black people in the United States quite legitimately can say that there is a sense in which they lack the power to command the sort of respect from the rest of society that you'd need to have in order for them to say with conviction, our lives matter for their own sake. They don't, right? And that's the problem. And that's why it's a kind of an affront to human dignity. But it's a social thing for me, not an individual property.
Yeah, that's good. I wonder if you could say a little bit more about, you know, why you choose is it a metaphor of the economy that you employ, or is this something in some sense, more than a metaphor, as it were? I'm interested in this in part for the normative reasons and in part for the empirical reasons that you say. I mean, on the normative side, it seems to me what you're pointing towards is some kind of, you know, a conception of an economy of respect that would be equal. So like that ultimately we would have an economy in which everyone gets equal kinds of respect in one way or another. The empirical side of things, I'm interested because it's, you know, in some sense you can, just like economists do, you can actually empirically operationalize what, like, you know, so you can redeem the Black Lives Matter claim and you can say, hey, look, here's my empirical evidence for the inegalitarian economy of respect in this sense.
Could you just repeat the first part? It's popped out of my head, the first part of what you just said.
Well, the normative side is about the equality of the economy, right? That everyone deserves a kind of equal recognition.
Well, yeah. So I I don't say this in the book, but I meant to say it, but I didn't get around to it. And maybe I'll write it up. I mean, I actually, in the end of the day, don't think that the economy of respect is in that sense an egalitarian one. I think probably it's going to be something more like a kind of sufficiency economy, right? That in order to, you know, have your claim on public and common responsibility redeemed, it has to be the case that people around you treat you with sufficient respect for you to be able to assure yourself and everybody else to be able to assure yourself that your life mattered for its own sake, right? I'm not sure, you know, whether talking about sort of equal amounts of respect is particularly helpful here. I mean, equality is important just in the same sense that when Marx talks about commodities being equivalent to each other through exchange value, right? I mean, what he's saying is that they're commensurable. He's not saying that means that all commodities have the same exchange value, right? But they do have to be in some way comparable. And as you perhaps will remember from the text, what I want to say about love and respect is, this is connected to what I said about hierarchy and precedence, respect is always in that sense commensurable, because if I respect one person, it always raises the question of, well, what does that mean for how I respect a different kind of person? And if there's a kind of discontinuity between those two things, an arbitrary discontinuity, if it's inflected by something like skin color or ethnicity or something like that, then I'm not really honoring the kind of equivalence that ought to hold, right? So that would be my account of phenomena like discrimination and racism. Yeah.
Yeah, good. I realized, I think the first part that you're referring to, I was asking about the motivation for the turn to economy in
general, right?
I mean, that,
whether it's a metaphor. Yes, that's right.
And whether it's a metaphor or not, and what's useful about it in your view. Yeah.
Well, I mean, what I used the language of metaphor a little bit early on. And in fact, you know, in a way that I may turn out to regret, talk about human dignity really as a metaphor. I mean, I think in the end of the day, what's important for my argument is not whether you classify these categories, human dignity or the idea of an effective, as I call it, team anthropic economy, that is an economy that values lives and people as opposed to objects or commodities. It matters less whether you want to call those, whether you classify those as metaphors or not. Maybe they are in some sense. What's important to me, and I think for my argument, is that whatever you classify them as formally, they're capturing something real about the world, right? So, you know, if you think of just stick with, you know, basic commercial economies, right? I mean, I read Marx as saying that if you have a commercial economy, you not only have a certain kind of material base, you have a whole complicated set of understandings, almost like a language, that allow us to engage in common conversation about what something is worth relative to that, whether you overpaid or underpaid, whether this is profitable or unprofitable, right? We've got that language in place. It's a mistake, I think, and I'm sure Marx would agree, it's a mistake to think of, I mean, whether you call it a metaphor or not, doesn't really matter. Maybe it certainly isn't a physical thing, right? That's right. Maybe it's a term of art. Maybe it's symbolic in some way. But regardless of how you classify it formally, the effect of this shared metric of commercial valuation is not purely notional or ideal. It makes a huge difference to how people's lives go. If you go bankrupt, for example, we know that someone's bankrupt because you can look at their assets and liabilities and you can see that doesn't match up. They have no further moves available. That's a real thing that happens to people. I mean, your business goes bust, you really go bust, right? So whether you call the descriptions metaphors or not, I don't think matters so much to me. What matters to me is that whatever you call them, they're capturing something that isn't just spin, that they're capturing something that actually happens in the social world. And I think, you know, I have this analysis of the sort of devalorization of the Nazi Holocaust, right? I mean, I want to say the victims of the Holocaust really were checkmated as far as, you know, their lives mattering for their own sakes. They lacked the power to get their lives to really matter. And that's what's really offensive and appalling about it. It's less a matter of the immorality of particular individual officials or soldiers or camp guards. It's much more about a structural situation in which certain groups of people come to lack the power totally to command affects of humane and respectful attention from others. And that's a form of, again, maybe this is a metaphor, it's a form of kind of timanthropic bankruptcy. It's a sense in which you cannot valorize yourself. Right. It's not all your fault. It's the structure.
All the tokens are on one side, and
yes,
no tokens belong to one. Yeah, that's helpful. Yeah, so maybe, I mean, time's running short here. I don't want to take up all your time today, Colin. But let me ask. I mean, you know, I think you've mentioned a couple times sort of the benefits of your view over the traditionalist view. But I thought maybe you could sort of, you know, sort of nail this a little bit more squarely, mm-hmm. in the sense that, you know, I mean, how is it that your revisionist approach, I think, can can address examples like the Nazi example or other examples in for the purposes of political criticism, you know, can address and justify forms of political criticism better than the traditionalist conception of dignity can.
Yeah, I don't think I'm going to be able to give a totally satisfactory answer to that, because I think that really is the big question that the book leaves us with. And I'm certainly not committing myself to a prediction of success in that regard. You know, the Nazi Holocaust is an easy case. I mean, you know, we don't really need anyone's theorization of human dignity to be able to know that whatever a human indignity is, this exemplifies it. So, you know, the test of this view is going to be whether it can give us more discriminating, fine-grained guidance in more controversial cases. And I certainly haven't shown that in the book. You know, I guess what I would, I mean, there are hints offered along the way in the final chapter. I guess what I would want to say, and this is partly, I think, connected to my critique of maybe Hayek a little bit, is that I think I've achieved something in this direction if I get people to stop saying, as, for example, Joel Feinberg was apt to say, right, that all we need for the purposes of deliberating publicly about the requirements of human dignity is to ask whether people have certain kinds of rights and whether they're in a position to exercise them, right? I don't disagree that that's going to be part of the answer, right? But it's going to depend, I think, on the content of the right. I don't myself see how the right to every last penny of your fortune that you've earned on a free market, right? Your right not to be redistributively taxed, right, for the sake of the disadvantaged, right? I don't see how, even if you thought that that was in some sense a right by Lockean standards, I have a right to, you know, my earned income, right? Even if you accepted that I have a rightful claim on it, right? The idea that it's some kind of affront to the dignity of the wealthy, or that it somehow impairs dignified relationships between the wealthy and the disadvantaged to ask them to pay taxes to support a national health service or something like that, right? The idea that that encases a failure to attend respectfully to the wealthy, that seems to me to be for the birds, right? There's a real difference between, you know, increasing the tax rate of people already doing very, very well in order to provide for people who are certainly living pretty undignified lives by any lights. So, you know, my hope is that, you know, in a potentially empirically informed way, we could start to move past these sorts of ideological fixtures where people say, well, I have it by right, and that's all you need to say. And of course, dignitarian humanism since Rawls, and especially in the libertarian tradition, has often had that quality, right? I've earned it by right. All respect for dignity requires is you respect my right and not tax me, because that's forced labor. You'd be manipulating me in some way. And that strikes me, again, you might want to call it a metaphor, but it's a totally fantastic metaphor. One, the dignity of anyone is not really at stake in that, I think. I mean, in real forced labor, of course it is, but a slightly higher tax rate for redistributive purposes just seems to me not to be in the same ballpark. So my hope is that by sort of naturalizing human dignity, by looking at what other people, what dispositions other people, either as private persons or perhaps more importantly in institutional settings, how their institutional roles dispose them to treat people with respect or disrespect, right? We can make more discriminating judgments about how human dignity is faring. I mean, another topic that I hope to address in future work is bureaucracy. You know, and I think there's a stat, it's related in some ways to your worries about technocracy and paternalism, but, you know, I think that whether all forms of bureaucracy are entirely compatible with human dignity is not obviously clear to me, because very often what bureaucrats are doing is following a rule and not paying the slightest attention to the needs, concerns, interests of the actual human being that's in front of them. And that's what makes bureaucratic encounters often so humiliating. And it's not just how you feel about it. It's what the bureaucracies reduce you to. You're just a file, you know, and there's an algorithm, and it's the fetishism of rules rather than attending in a humane way to the person you're dealing with.
That's great, Colin. Well, we could have this conversation for hours, I think, but in the interest of time, let me conclude by just saying I really appreciate your time and thank you for this great conversation and for joining me on the Political Theory.
No, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And thank you so much for the opportunity. It was great.
You've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.